you go somewhere else? Well, sometimes I say, why don't you go back to where you came from, you know, which might be Brooklyn. Well, this notion of superiority and exceptionalism starts early. Well, here in Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630, the colony had just begun, and the governor, Winthrop, talked about the Massachusetts Bay Colony as a city on a hill. I think Reagan embellished it a little and talked about a golden city on a hill. Well, the idea of a city on a hill, you've probably heard that expression a number of times, the idea of a city on a hill is a nice one, because it suggests a model. It suggests setting an example. I mean, that is a wonderful thing to be. But it doesn't stop there with just being a city on a hill. After Governor Winthrop utters these words about being a city on a hill, just a few years later, the people in the city on a hill move out to massacre the Pequot Indians. Between what the government does and what God approves of. That process of not being just a city on a hill, but of moving out, of expanding, that's a persistent fact of American history, going all the way back to those first settlers and coming down to the present day.
Gatherings, the big gathering they had at Carnegie Hall for the 75th birthday of Paul Robeson, and you'll find the Harry Belafontes, all of the towering artists who knew that they owed a tremendous debt to Paul Robeson. It's very interesting at that gathering. I think one of those powerful words were said by Coretta Scott King at that gathering. She was still mourning the death of Martin, and she said, "America did to Paul Robeson what I think they ended up doing to Martin. They buried him alive." See, Coretta's hitting on something deep. Inexcusable treatment of a person who had the courage to tell America about itself in regard to its injustices. They bury him alive.
That's Cornel West, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Cornel West on the legacy of Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson is one of the 20th century's most enduring and multi-talented figures. He broke through the color line and excelled in sports, film, music, and theater. He became world famous, yet in the United States, he was to be persecuted and hounded for his political beliefs. In his recordings, particularly of spirituals and folk songs, Robeson's mellifluous bass baritone voice awakened African Americans to their heritage and gained him a broad audience. He won acclaim on Broadway, especially in the musical Showboat, in which he sang the classic Old Man River. His dramatic performance in Othello is legendary. By the 1930s, he was singing in major concert halls all over the United States and Europe. By the early 1940s, one biographer states that Robeson was the most famous black man in America. Theodore Dreiser, the well-known writer of the day, hailed Robeson as an artistic and social genius. Never content to be just an entertainer, Robeson had strong political views and he wasn't afraid to express them. He condemned racism and segregation in the United States. He was an anti-imperialist who advocated the liberation of Africa and Asia.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of W.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The thing to understand about Musk is that he operates on that internet-style, fluid, improvisational way of doing things. He's like a live streamer who's busted into a nuclear missile silo, and in the chat is every weirdo from the Heritage Foundation, the America First Institute, every groiper, and they're just in the chat going like, press that button, break that, see what happens. It can feel like he's just buffeting us with chaos, but once you understand what's going on, it makes a lot more sense.
As 21 staffers at Doge resign in protest over Elon Musk's moves to jeopardize the sensitive data of millions of Americans and dismantle much of the federal government, we'll speak to Cory Doctorow, the science fiction writer, activist, and prominent critic of big tech. Then to the anti-death penalty crusader, Sister Helen Prejean.
I am overjoyed at the news that the Supreme Court of the United States overturned Richard Glossop's death sentence and declared that he needs to have a new trial. Lies were told at his trial and prosecution allowed it. It's all exposed, and so this man has a chance for freedom.
And finally, the National Guard's been called into prisons here in New York as prison guards continue a wildcat strike at Attica and other prisons. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Federal courts have ordered a pause to much of President Trump's agenda in a trio of rulings involving refugees, federal spending, and foreign aid. In the first ruling on Tuesday, U.S. District Judge Lauren Ali Khan in Washington, D.C., ordered the White House to pause its spending freeze on grants, loans, and other financial aid. In a second ruling, U.S. District Judge Jamal Whitehead in Seattle blocked Trump's executive order suspending refugee admissions and funding. And in a third case, U.S. District Judge Amir Ali in Washington, D.C., ordered the Trump administration to comply with his order from 2 weeks ago to unfreeze billions of dollars for foreign assistance grants and contracts. U.S. federal workers face fresh uncertainty after billionaire Elon Musk gave them a second chance to respond to his order that they justify their jobs or risk termination. Musk's latest directive came in a post on his social media site X late Monday. It contradicted guidance from the Office of Personnel Management, telling workers they could ignore Musk's earlier email ordering them to summarize their accomplishments or risk losing their jobs. On Tuesday, Trump added to the chaos and uncertainty with these comments.
Well, it's somewhat voluntary, but it's also if you don't answer, I guess you get fired.
On Tuesday, Doge quietly dropped false claims from its website about what it called its five biggest savings to U.S. taxpayers. The reversals included Doge's claim of $8 billion in cuts at Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The figure was, in fact, $8 million. Elon Musk will join President Trump's first cabinet meeting scheduled for today, even though Musk was not confirmed by the Senate to a cabinet post and is listed by the White House as a special government employee. The White House said Tuesday Musk is not the head of Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency. Instead, the White House said Doge's interim administrator is Amy Gleason, who's worked at the U.S. Digital Service during Trump's first term before Musk rebranded it. The New York Times reports Gleason is on vacation in Mexico, was not aware of the White House plan to make her role public now. Meanwhile, 21 DOGE staffers have quit in protest of Musk's actions, writing in a joint resignation letter, quote, "We will not use our skills as technologists to compromise core government systems, jeopardize Americans' sensitive data, or dismantle critical public services," they wrote. The Republican-led House of Representatives has narrowly approved a budget framework for much of President Trump's agenda, proposing $4.5 trillion in tax cuts and a $2 trillion reduction in federal spending over the next decade. Among other provisions, the budget would likely slash about $800 billion over a decade from Medicaid, threatening health care coverage to more than 72 million people. All 215 House Democrats voted against the budget. On Tuesday, the Congressional Progressive Caucus launched a campaign for an alternative budget, the, quote, "Tax the Greedy Billionaires Coalition." Ukrainian officials say at least 7 people were killed overnight as Russia launched a wave of deadly drone strikes on the capital Kyiv and parts of eastern Ukraine. Separately, Russia said it shot down scores of Ukrainian drones launched into the Russian annexed region of Crimea. The fighting came as the White House hinted Ukraine is prepared to sign a deal granting the U.S. access to Ukrainian resources, including oil, gas and rare earth minerals. Trump said Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will visit the White House Friday to sign the agreement. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says a delegation of U.S. diplomats will meet with their Russian counterparts in Istanbul Thursday to restore diplomatic ties after the U.S. and Russia withdrew embassy staff at the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago. Israel and Hamas have reached a deal on the release of 620 Palestinian prisoners, including women and children, imprisoned by Israel in exchange for the bodies of 4 Israeli hostages who died in Gaza. The swap will take place Thursday after Israel delayed the release of hundreds of Palestinians in a move Hamas officials said was another attempt to sabotage the Gaza ceasefire. This comes as the United Nations is urging Israel to allow mobile homes and shelters into Gaza after 6 Palestinian infants died from hypothermia due to the freezing cold. Meanwhile, school children have joyfully returned to school in Gaza for the first time since October 2023.
After an absence of about a year and a half, we returned to school. The feeling is indescribable. Honestly, it's a unique and special feeling. However, there's a slight flaw. It's not really a school. First of all, the walls are destroyed. There are no benches, no blackboards. We even brought our prayer mats with us to sit on. And they were barely enough. There are no teaching materials available to help us study. Despite all of this, we overcame this condition.
Nearly all of Gaza's schools have been destroyed by Israel. In Syria, at least 2 people are dead after Israel's military launched air raids on the capital and parts of southern Syria. On Tuesday, low-flying Israeli warplanes rattled residents of Damascus before dropping bombs on the nearby town of Kiswe. Separately, Israel bombed sites in the southern province of Daraa. Israel's military later said it had struck military command centers and multiple sites containing weapons. The attacks came just hours after Syria's transitional government demanded Israel withdraw from Syrian territory it's occupied since rebels ousted Bashar al-Assad in December. International Criminal Court prosecutor Karim Khan arrived in the Democratic Republic of Congo Tuesday in a push to end violence that's seen Rwanda-backed M23 soldiers overrun cities in the eastern DRC, killing more than 7,000 people while displacing hundreds of thousands. Speaking to reporters in the capital, Kinshasa, Karim Khan laid out his goals for the visit.
To try to make sure there is a consistent, there is a comprehensive, there is a sustainable and holistic approach to justice that draws the poison of criminality away from the soil and allows the people and your children to march forward to, God willing, a brighter future after these very dark days that you're going through right now.
On Tuesday, the United Kingdom announced a pause on some bilateral aid to Rwanda and other diplomatic sanctions over Kigali's role in supporting M23. The Trump administration's announced a new visa ban targeting Cuban officials who are tied to a decades-old program that primarily sends Cuban doctors and healthcare workers to assist other countries. Secretary of State Marco Rubio erroneously described the program as forced labor. Cuba began deploying doctors around the world after the 1959 Cuban Revolution to disaster sites and during disease outbreaks, such as the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic and during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Cuba's foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, slammed the restrictions as part of Rubio's, quote, personal agenda, unquote. Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants, has been persistently advocating for harsher sanctions on Cuba despite the catastrophic impacts. The White House has announced plans to handpick the pool reporters who will be allowed to ask President Trump questions, breaking from decades of precedent that saw the White House Correspondents Association determine which journalists have close access to the president. Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt announced the changes on Tuesday.
A select group of D.C.-based journalists should no longer have a monopoly over the privilege of press access at the White House. All journalists, outlets, and voices deserve a seat at this highly coveted table. So by deciding which outlets make up the limited press pool on a day-to-day basis, the White House will be restoring power back to the American people.
The White House Correspondents Association condemned the changes, writing, quote, "This move tears at the independence of a free press in the United States. It suggests the government will choose the journalists who cover the president. In a free country, leaders must not be able to choose their own press corps," unquote. On Monday, a federal judge denied a request from the Associated Press for a temporary restraining order after the Trump administration cut off AP's access to cover major events at the White House unless it agrees to follow Trump's order that it refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. The Trump administration's moving forward with plans to force millions of undocumented people to register with the federal government or face criminal prosecution. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem threatened undocumented immigrants with being hunted down and deported if they fail to register, fulfilling another one of Trump's executive orders signed on his first day in office. This comes as a group of elite military contractors, including former CEO and founder of the for-profit mercenary company Blackwater, Eric Prince, has offered to set up so-called processing camps on military bases and deploying an army of private citizens to arrest immigrants. The blueprint has an estimated cost of $25 billion and would certainly face legal and operational challenges. Prince is the brother of former Trump Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. In Tennessee, Republican lawmakers have introduced a bill that would prohibit undocumented immigrants from pursuing most lawsuits, such as suing for medical malpractice. This is Nashville civil rights attorney Chris Smith.
It deprives undocumented immigrants of the right to bring a declaratory judgment action. That's the vehicle under Tennessee law where you can challenge the constitutionality of a statute. So by saying you can't even file lawsuits to challenge the constitutionality, it's a complete stripping of rights of undocumented people.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ordered a new trial for Richard Glossop, who's been in Oklahoma's death row for nearly three decades. Glossop has for years maintained his innocence after being convicted as the mastermind behind the 1997 murder for hire of his former employer. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast with Glossop's spiritual advisor, anti-death penalty activist, Sister Helen Prejean. In a victory for labor rights, the food delivery app DoorDash has been ordered to pay nearly $17 million for secretly using customer tips to subsidize the wages of its delivery workers here in New York, instead of allowing them to keep their tips on top of their guaranteed wages. The payout will go toward thousands of DoorDash workers, most of whom are immigrants, who made deliveries between May 2017 and September 2019. In a statement, Gustavo Arce, a leader with the group Los Deliveristas Unidos, said on X, quote, "I am proud of our fight, and recovering this money that belongs to the workers is a great victory. Personally, I'm always grateful to the thousands of New Yorkers for their generosity, but we're always on the sidelines of someone who wants to take advantage of us. But we are here to fight for justice and dignity, si se puede," he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Trump's holding his first cabinet meeting today. The White House has confirmed attendees will include Elon Musk, the world's richest man, who's expected to talk about DOGE, the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, which is working to dismantle the entire U.S. government agencies and reduce government services. Earlier this week, 21 staffers at DOGE resigned in protest over Musk's actions. In a joint resignation letter, the engineers, data scientists, designers, and product managers wrote, quote, "We will not use our skills as technologists to compromise core government systems, jeopardize American sensitive data, or dismantle critical public services. We will not lend our expertise to carry out or legitimize DOGE's actions," they wrote. The mass resignation comes amidst growing questions over the legality and effectiveness of DOGE's actions. Last week, DOGE claimed it had saved taxpayers $8 billion by canceling a single immigration-related contract. In fact, it wasn't $8 billion. The contract was $8 million. DOGE has since removed reference to this and four other large contracts it had highlighted on its so-called wall of receipts, removing all top five. While Musk is attending today's cabinet meeting, the White House claims it's claiming the actual head of DOGE is a little-known government employee named Amy Gleason, currently on vacation in Mexico. She reportedly was not aware the White House was planning to reveal her name. Meanwhile, Musk has given a new ultimatum to federal workers to justify their jobs or risk being fired, this despite pushback from several agency heads. As Elon Musk tries to reshape the federal government, much like he did after taking over Twitter, we're joined by a prominent critic of big tech, Cory Doctorow. He's a science fiction author, activist, and journalist. He works for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He has a new book out. It's called Picks and Shovels, a Martin Hench novel. Cory, it's great to have you with us at the table here in New York. Why don't you start off by responding to what Elon Musk is doing? He'll be apparently at this cabinet meeting, though he's not a cabinet member approved by the Senate today, with President Trump. When did you first come to know Elon Musk? And tell us a story.
Oh, it's a funny story. So I'm a science fiction writer. I write, broadly speaking, cyberpunk novels. I've also been involved in digital rights for about 25 years. And one day Elon Musk tweeted that he considered himself a utopian socialist in the model of E&M Banks. Now, I knew Banks a little. He was a friend and a friendly colleague of mine, a socialist science fiction writer from Scotland. And I said, I knew Ian. He was an ardent trade unionist. You're under innumerable investigations by the NLRB. I don't think you can call yourself a utopian socialist in his model and his mode. And Musk replied,
"Remember, no curses."
Yeah, indeed. Musk replied, "Well, I've read his classic culture novel series, and there are no trade unions there." And I said, "Yes, but it takes place in a far future where you have giant spaceships with a trillion people on them traveling at 1,000 times the speed of light, controlled by artificial intelligences with many millions of times the capacity of human beings." And he said, "Well, I have very advanced factories to make my Teslas." And I said, "There is an enormous difference between the world imagined by Ian Banks and the process of eking out very tiny gains in the efficiency of making electric vehicles." And he called me an enemy of humanity and blocked me. So that was my only experience with him. But, you know, like innumerable tech bros, he has mistaken cyberpunk for a suggestion rather than a warning. As someone who is in the business of writing a lot of warnings, I find this baffling and indeed very demoralizing.
And Cory, you also work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is tries to defend freedom and technology, law and policy. Well, how do you respond to Musk's claim that he believes in free speech absolutism?
Well, I'm very proud to have worked with the EFF for 23 years. We are the first organization to have filed a lawsuit that names Musk and DOGE by name. We're suing over the Privacy Act for the privacy of Americans and federal workers. You know, this idea that Musk is the apotheosis of a kind of tech ethic it's easy to fall into if all you pay attention to are tech bosses and the odd, you know, broccoli hair brown shirt that they send into our federal agencies. But when you look at what tech workers have historically done, you find a cohort of people who, by and large, got interested in tech because they themselves experienced something profound and liberatory by connecting to networks that connected them to people all over the world and to, you know, disfavor political views like the idea that Black Lives Matter or women shouldn't be routinely sexually harassed by their bosses. All of these things that have come to the fore thanks to the ability of people to organize over tech. And they want to bring that liberatory power to other people. And often they've been able to hold the line against their bosses, even as their bosses opted for this very callow, you know, rent-seeking approach to things. Because tech workers were in such high demand, they weren't unionized, but they had a lot of power that arose from their scarcity. The fact that you could walk across the street from any big tech shop and get another job the same day that paid just as well, if not better, as the job you were in, meant that tech workers often told their bosses to go to hell when their bosses told them to screw up the things that they'd missed their mother's funerals to ship on time. And so even as we saw the dismantling of other forces that disciplined tech companies, the dismantling of antitrust law that allowed these companies to buy all their competitors, merge to monopoly, and reduce the internet to five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four, the regulatory capture that sees grotesqueries like Keir Starmer firing their top tech trustbuster and replacing him last month with the former head of Amazon UK. As we saw the expansion of IP law that made it illegal to jailbreak devices and add ad blockers and privacy blockers and do other things that allow, say, gig workers to refuse to take jobs unless the wage rose to a threshold that all the gig workers in a region agreed was sufficient for a living wage. Even as those forces melted away, you saw tech workers holding the line against their bosses. And I think this is one of the reasons that tech bosses are so horny about AI. If you listen to the rhetoric carefully, you'll hear that what they really are excited about is not just the idea of generically replacing labor with AI, but specifically replacing coders with AI. And if you talk to experienced coders about what it's like to co-pilot your programming session with AI, very experienced coders say, oh, well, I can get a little bit of efficiency gains around the edges. But the idea that you replace all those very experienced coders and replace them with low-level coders without much experience who just supervise the AI is a recipe for producing tech debt at scale where you have lurking bugs that eventually come back to bite you in the butt. But for tech bosses, firing this uppity workforce, adding to the 250,000 that they fired in 2023, the 150,000 they fired in 2024, the tens of thousands they fired this year, the ones that Facebook has just announced they're going to fire with a 5% across-the-board wage cut that's coupled with double bonuses for their executives this year. You know, this is the thing that excites them, is the ability to get rid of the last group of people who, like these tech workers who just resigned from the U.S. government, have said, I will not allow my boss to harm my users.
I wanted to ask you a speech you gave in Toronto on Monday evening. You talked about the Trump presidency as an existential crisis, but also one that presents opportunities. What kind of opportunities?
Yeah, sure. You know, when life gives you SARS, you got to make sarsaparilla. And if you look at the worst tech policies around the world, they came at the end of a coercive process delivered by the U.S. trade representative who said that if you want free trade with the U.S., if you don't have to pay tariffs when your goods are exported to the U.S., you are going to have to agree that it's illegal to reverse engineer and modify U.S. tech products, which means that you can't modify the digital diagnostic system in a car so that any mechanic can fix it without buying $10,000 per vendor tools from the official vendors. It means that if you want to refill printer ink cartridges so that you can make your own generic ink in country rather than paying the American firms like HP the incredible premiums they charge on ink. I mean, I know ink is not our biggest issue here, but ink cost $10,000 a gallon. It's the most expensive fluid you as a civilian can purchase without a permit. Ink is so expensive that now you print your grocery lists with colored water that costs more per milliliter than the semen of a Kentucky Derby winning stallion. And the only reason that Canada, Mexico, European countries in the global south can't refill their ink cartridges is reverse engineering the lock on the ink cartridge is illegal. Now, if the only reason we have these laws is because these countries have pursued a tariff-free relationship with the U.S., and if Trump is engaged in this like unscheduled mid mid-air disassembly of the global trade system, and now we have Canadians faced with 25% across-the-board tariffs to ship their goods to the U.S. Why bother keeping these laws on the books? And if they do remove these laws, if we do allow domestic tech competitors all over the world to reverse engineer, modify, and erode the high monopoly rents extracted by these American tech firms, we do something very effective in this trade war, because the only thing keeping the S&P 500 afloat are these tech monopolists. If you take the big tech stocks out of the S&P 500, you've got a stock market that has been in decline for a decade. And when you look, decompose their balance sheets and you see where they get all their money, it's from price gouging on repairs, service, parts, consumables, software. You know, every time a Canadian software author writes an app and a Canadian customer buys that app, 30 cents of every dollar that Canadian customer spends makes a round trip through Cupertino, California, where Apple takes 30 cents out of it. We could just abolish that system and create a 30% premium for every newspaper that collects subscription dollars through an app, every software author, every musician, every book author, every music or games creator who runs through these big U.S. app stores. And if you did this, you would kick American big industry right in the dongle. You know, if you're angry at Elon Musk, you know, don't just get performatively offended about his Nazi salutes. Make it legal for mechanics all over the world to jailbreak Teslas so that every subscription feature in that Tesla that generates the recurring revenue source that creates Tesla's ridiculous earnings to valuation ratio, all of those car owners can just for one price get all that service unlocked. Elon Musk never gets another dime from them. That really hits him where it hurts. He loves the attention that he gets from the Nazi salute. He's going to be a lot less happy if he can't get, you know, a couple hundred bucks every month from every Tesla owner for access to the full battery or the acceleration curve or any of the other things that he sells as a subscription in his cars.
Elon Musk recently appeared on Fox News, as usual, alongside President Trump, defending his actions at Doge.
One of the biggest functions of the Doge team is just making sure that the presidential executive orders are actually carried out. And this is, I just want to point out, this is a very important thing, because the president is the elected representative of the people. So he's representing the will of the people. And if the bureaucracy is fighting the will of the people and preventing the president from implementing what the people want, then what we live in is a bureaucracy and not a democracy.
So that's what some of what Elon Musk said. But I also want to follow up with what just happened at HUD, Housing and Urban Development, the agency. All the workers were ordered back. Washington Post reporting that the Trump administration plans to slash what half of the workforce of HUD. Current and former employees said the cuts are likely to upend housing markets, make homes less affordable, royal mortgage transactions. On Monday, when workers return to work, the screens all over HUD on all the floors at HUD headquarters were apparently hacked to show a looped AI-generated video portraying, and we're going to show this, President Trump kissing the feet of Elon Musk. The video was labeled in big white letters, "Long live the real king." Even as a science fiction writer, Cory Doctorow, could you have imagined anything more strange than this reality we're living in right now?
Well, I, as a science fiction writer, I especially appreciate the fact that Elon Musk has two left feet in that AI-generated image. You could not ask for a stupider timeline than the one in which you get these AI gonks in your weird propaganda videos. Look, this is a funny spectacle. It's very interesting to see, I'm sure this gave heart to a lot of demoralized HUD workers. And the point of this chaotic blitz is to demoralize their opponents, right? In the reality-based world, even if you are worried about government waste, even if you want to make the government smaller, you have to acknowledge the empirical fact that payroll accounts for 4% of the federal budget. If Elon Musk manages to cut 50% of the federal workforce, a move that would leave us without functional roads or aviation or any of these other things that you kind of need if you're going to make money out of the economy, he would cut 2% of the federal budget. You know, you can find a couple $1 trillion in government waste. All you have to do is look for beltway bandits who are marking up their services to the U.S. government by triple-digit margins. Unfortunately, those aren't the people that they're pursuing.
And Corey, I wanted to ask you about Luigi Mangione, the 26-year-old suspect or charged with the shooting death of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. This is eerily reminiscent of one of your novels, Radicalized, in 2018. Could you talk about that novel and also how this issue personally relates to your own life?
And Juan, Corey's having a little trouble hearing you, but he's asking about Luigi Mangione and if you can relate it to what happened there with also your own experience.
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to have to out myself here. I'm a Canadian, like all the best Americans. We're everywhere. We're just like serial killers. We look just like everyone else. And in 2019, I published this book called Radicalized. And there's a novella in it, this title novella, Radicalized, which was a rumination on my experience as a Canadian moving to the United States and for the first time encountering this gun culture firsthand and being somewhat baffled, not just by the, you know, obvious problems of having guns everywhere, but by the very strange nature of gun violence, right? We have a country in which very heavily armed, very angry men shoot people for the most absurd reasons, right? In my local subreddit for the town I live in Burbank, you will see people saying, well, I hate the people who use their phones in the movie theater, but I wouldn't dare say anything to them about it because they might shoot me. You know, I was only in country for a few days before someone told me you must never flip off someone in traffic. They're going to kill you. And yet you have these guys, mostly guys, heavily armed, who have the people they love most in the world, their wives, their children, who are being condemned to die by insurance executives who've taken thousands of dollars out of their paycheck every month since they entered the workforce. And those people walk around seemingly without ever fearing anything. So I wrote this novella about a message board where these guys hang out, a message board for men whose wives and children are dying of cancer and who've been denied care through the insurance market, and who, just like a lot of other online communities full of very angry people, turns into a festering pit of violence, and who then embark on a campaign of suicide bombings and killings across the country. Men who've lost everything, lost their families, and find themselves with nothing else to live for. It was a thought experiment. It was a way of reflecting on something that I found odd here in America. And when Luigi Mangione allegedly shot that insurance executive, I certainly felt a bit of the cold grew. When they found his Goodreads, I was very hopeful and ultimately gratified to see that he hadn't read my book and mistaken it for an instruction manual. But really, I think the strangest question about this is, how did it take so long for this to happen, right? How did it take so long for people who are so angry to target the people who hurt them the most instead of their intimate partners or the guy who cut them off in traffic or the person using their phone in the movie theater?
And finally, Cory Doctorow, we're talking about the old book, Radicalized. You've got a new book. You're traveling the country and the world promoting Picks and Shovels, a Martin Hench novel, wearing your mask so you can be safe. Very quickly, summarize it for us and what it's like to be going around this country at this moment.
Sure. So Martin Hench is this recurring forensic accountant character that I've written now in three different books. His story is that from the 1980s to the mid-2020s, he has been in Silicon Valley, unwinding every scam that every tech bro could cook up. And he's kind of the Zelig of high-tech crime. So wherever you have a scam, you've got Martin Hench. In this novel, I go back to his origin story, the early 1980s, where as an MIT dropout who leaves the computer science program because he's too busy programming computers to do his computer science homework, he ends up getting a CPA, following his genius programmer roommate to Silicon Valley, and getting embroiled in one of the weird PC fights of the days, because the PCs were very weird when they first kicked off. He ends up in a battle between two companies. One's called Fidelity Computing. It's a pyramid-selling scheme that targets faith groups run by a Mormon bishop, an Orthodox rabbi, and a Catholic priest who recruit parishioners to prey upon one another, to sell each other crappy PCs that are locked into their ecosystem forever. There's sort of a primitive pyramid scheme Apple where you can only use their special fanfold paper with slightly wider sprockets and their printers, their special floppies and their floppy drives. Their software isn't compatible with anything else. And there is is a rival company founded by three women who were his top sales reps who have left this company to found a rival company to rescue these parishioners who've been trapped in this grift. One is an Orthodox woman who's left the faith because she came out as a lesbian and her family kicked her out. One is a Mormon woman who's left the LDS over its opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. And one, your next guest will like this, is a nun who's left her order because she's gotten involved with liberation theology movements in Central America during the Dirty Wars. And they're kicking off what seems like a commercial battle, but which turns into a shooting war, because people who are willing to make millions of dollars stealing from their parishioners are not above spectacular acts of violence to maintain that grift. What I think of this book as is a return to the first days of computing, when the seeds of a word I coined that I can't say on the air for reasons that anyone who's watched a famous George Carlin sketch will know, a word we can euphemistically call impoopification.
You're famous for this word.
This word that was the word of the year by the American Dialect Society, Australia's Macquarie Dictionary, the British New Scientist magazine. Impoopification, soon coming to a book from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux next October, is a theory that describes platform decay, how these platforms lock people in and then abuse them and become worse and worse, but we can't seem to leave them until they're just a giant pile of crap. And we've all experienced this decay of platforms that we relied on in so many ways. And, you know, the seeds of that were planted back in the 1980s. There were always people who looked at computers and thought about how they could use them to exploit, surveil, and lock in the people around them. And then there were people who looked at them and saw in them the potential for a great liberatory project. And that fight between good and evil has been underway since the 80s. But in the 80s, something remarkable happened. You had the ascent of neoliberalism and the dismantling of antitrust law. You know, we forget this, but the Apple II Plus went on sale the same year Ronald Reagan went on the campaign trail. And this was the moment in which we started to legalize new predatory forms of capitalism. It's the moment where pyramid schemes were legalized by Gerry Ford. And so that's why I find myself writing about this now.
Well, Cory Doctorow is who you're listening to. He's a science fiction author, activist, journalist. His new book just out is Picks and Shovels, a Martin Hench novel. Cory Doctorow has been working at the Electronic Frontier Foundation for over 20 years. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at a rare victory for death row prisoner Richard Glossop before the U.S. Supreme Court. It threw out his conviction and called for a new trial. We'll speak with his spiritual advisor, anti-death penalty crusader Sister Helen Bajan, back in 20 seconds. Yeah!
Children dying, mama's crying, 'cause daddy's lying on the floor. Bullets flying.
Mama's Cryin' by Territorial from the album Tlashiwiki, released by Die Jim Crow Records and recorded by incarcerated people at the Colorado prison, the Territorial Correctional Facility. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at a rare victory for a death row prisoner before the U.S. Supreme Court. On Tuesday, three of the court's conservative justices joined with the three liberals to throw out the conviction and death sentence of Oklahoma death row prisoner Richard Glossop, who's maintained his innocence for nearly three decades after being convicted as the mastermind behind the 1997 murder for hire of his former employer, a motel owner. Glossop's appeal was actually supported by Oklahoma's Republican Attorney General Gentner Drummond, who said he didn't receive a fair trial. Drummond's formal confession of error and request for a new trial was rejected by Oklahoma's Court of Criminal Appeals. But on Tuesday, the Supreme Court found long-suppressed evidence had undermined the case. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote in the majority opinion, quote, Glossop is entitled to a new trial. Richard Glossop has faced execution 9 times, has eaten 3 last meals. Someone who's been with him through much of that is his spiritual advisor, Sister Helen Prejean, one of the world's best-known anti-death penalty crusaders. She's the author of the best-selling book, Dead Man Walking, an eyewitness account of the death penalty, most recently, River of Fire, My Spiritual Journey. Sister Helen, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out how you believe this happened?
Well, I'll take it from the beginning. Early January 2015, I get a phone call, and it was from this man, Richard Glossop. And he goes, Sister Helen, I apologize. I didn't ask your permission, but I think Oklahoma is going to kill me. And I put you down to be with me. I'm sorry. I didn't ask your permission. And that's how we began. So I talked to him. Then I looked into his case. I'd heard a little bit before. Got to bed. Bolted awake at 2 in the morning going, I can't just be with a man and accompany him to death. I had enough experience with innocent people on death row that I decided I'd go visit him. And right away from what I'd heard of the case, we set up a press conference. In the beginning, you are up against every odd. What chance did we have? But everything in the case depended on this man, Justin Snead, who had already admitted that he had killed Barry Van Treese, this motel owner. And then later you find out that the investigators, the detectives are feeding to him, but wasn't Richard Glossop behind him, the whole murder? And so then they went after Richard as the mastermind. 10 years later now, this is with lawyers working, trying to get the evidence of what happened. They clearly exposed, it was the last box of evidence. They kept this box of evidence from them that showed that the prosecutor knew that Justin Snead was unreliable, had a bipolar disorder, and kept that from the jury. And if the jury had known that, it would have impeached his credibility. He was the lying meth addict, but they kept it, and it's called NAPU. When a prosecutor is aware that a lie is being told, they have a duty to correct that to the jury. And they didn't. And they got the evidence. In that last box of evidence, it showed that the prosecutor knew and lied. And on that basis, Sotomayor based the case, saying that's against due process. They knew the lie that he was telling, and they hid it from the jury, and that's what saved him. This is 10 years later. This is every court in Oklahoma, you know, upholding it. It's so hard to go after these prosecutors because they have immunity, and they are seldom censored. I mean, look, almost 30 years, Richard has lost his freedom, and he came close to death 3 times.
And Sister Helen, what about the significance of several conservatives on the Supreme Court joining with the liberal justices on this?
Yeah, not to mention an attorney general of this Republican conservative state, Gettner Drummond, who hopes to run for governor. And he did a brave, courageous, moral act because he could see that Richard really did not get a fair trial. And he spoke out. And then when the defense lawyers filed with the Supreme Court, he entered into it saying, I'm the attorney general of the state. And he's had huge backlash for that. And he stands out. It's such a rare thing in this country that politicians of a certain ideological stance are willing to make moral decisions. The legislators in the state also, all of them are Republicans, all of them pro-death penalty. Don Knight is the shining hero in this lawyer. And he went duck hunting with the lieutenant governor, and then he met people in the legislature. Then Joe Berlinger did a fantastic 2-part documentary, Killing Richard Glossop, which is out there. And the legislators could see the documentary, and then they met Richard in that personal meeting, and then they begin to assemble the facts, and they stood up. Amazing. I had never heard of it before, that this kind of coalition of people willing to make the right moral decision and standing up happen. It's an amazing story, and it just highlights what's so terribly wrong with the death penalty, and especially in the killing states, the deep south killing states. Oklahoma had all these executions, and we in Louisiana are facing that now. We have a governor who's installing gas. The Veterinarians Association 2 days ago had a press conference with little puppies and cats with a sign under their on their neck saying, don't gas humans, because they don't use gassing even for euthanasia of animals because it's cruel. And here we got a governor is going gung-ho to kill as many people as he can with gas. So Richard Glossop, God bless him, I believe he's going to be a free man, but look at it. Look at that whole system, the way the Supreme Court set up the death penalty in its administration. It gives this huge discretionary power to prosecutors to seek death or not, then for governors to initiate deaths if they feel they're not happening fast enough. And that's the state we're in. But we're working. And the sister, more you sister, educate the people.
Just, I wanted to ask you also, we've been covering a lot the first weeks of the Trump administration. At the end of Trump's first term in office, he carried out 13 executions, more than any other president in modern history. What are your thoughts on his executive order to pursue the death penalty for all crimes of a severity demanding its use?
That's that huge discretionary power I was talking about that the Supreme Court allowed. He lined up 13 people to kill, and then he went and killed them with Bill Barr as his attorney general. And there's almost nothing to stop it except what you're doing in Democracy Now!, what I do with books and getting to the people to educate them. I mean, we don't need to kill these people in Louisiana. We haven't had an execution in 17 years. One consensual one. The fire's gone out of this. I know the guards at Angola. Now you can involve good people in taking a fellow human being and rendering him defenseless and killing him. It's not fair to them either. We don't need this thing. It's time to shut it down. And take my state, Louisiana, and take Oklahoma. Look at the millions they spend every year in their budget to keep the death penalty in place. It's the most expensive way that in Louisiana, it's $13,600,000 above what it would cost for a person just to be in prison for life.
Sister Helen Prejean, we thank you so much for being with us. One of the world's most well-known anti-death penalty activists, spiritual advisor to Richard Glossop, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that he will get a new trial. And to see our extremely rare interview with the death row prisoner earlier this week, Keith Lamar in Youngstown, Ohio, in Supermax, scheduled to die at the beginning of 2027, also professing his innocence, go to democracynow.org. Next up, the National Guard has been called into prisons here in New York as prison guards continue a wildcat strike at Attica and other prisons. Back in 20 seconds. Years of Curtain Calls by Bryce Dessner from the soundtrack to the movie Sing Sing.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show here in New York, where state prison guards are on the second week of a wildcat strike over what they say are unsafe conditions. The National Guard have been called in. Some say the timing of the strike is curious. It started the same week charges were filed against prison guards at the Marcy Correctional Facility in Utica, New York, who brutally beat to death handcuffed prisoner Robert Brooks in an attack captured on video footage by body cameras. Brooks was black. All the officers who took turns beating him appear to be white. Meanwhile, prison officials have responded to the prison guard strike by indefinitely suspending provisions in New York's HALT Solitary Act, which stands for Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Solitary Confinement, which limits solitary confinement to 15 consecutive days or 20 days over a 60-day period. For more, we've got two guests with us. In Washington, D.C., Orisanmi Burton is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at American University, author of a book about the 1971 Attica prison uprising, upstate New York, titled Tip of the Spear, Black Radicalism, Prison Repression, and the Long Attica Revolt. And here in our New York studio is Jose Saldana, director of Release Aging People in Prison, known as RAP. He was released from New York State Prison in 2018 after 38 years behind bars. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jose, welcome back to Democracy Now! You're just back from the state capitol here in New York, from Albany. Talk about the significance of the wildcat strike and how it's affecting the prisoners.
Well, first of all, you know, for those who don't know, this is an illegal strike. The correction guards has just finished negotiating a contract a few months ago, and now they are going on strike. And the reason why they are going on strike is because the world saw that video. We call it a lynching. 14 to 16 correction prison guards lynched a black man. And the whole world saw it, and they're questioning, how long has this been going on in the prison system? So this illegal strike is to erase that consciousness that's building. We are building a consciousness to dismantle that type of racial brutality and sexual violence in the prison systems that have been going on for decades. They're trying to erase that.
And Jose, could you talk about the their demand that the reforms around solitary confinement be removed?
Yes, they want the Solitary Confinement Act repealed, and the solitary confinement does not only restrict them from putting people in the box for decades, actual decades. It also stops them from putting pregnant women in the box, women breastfeeding in the box. People who have mental health problems, people who have physical disability, paralyzed people, wheelchair bound. It prohibits them from putting these people in solitary confinement. They're trying to repeal that. They're trying to say that this whole solitary confinement had made their work dangerous. It had created a dangerous environment, and they actually are trying to erase what we saw in that video. The people who are living in a dangerous environment are the incarcerated men and women.
Is it true that a prisoner died this week? I'm not talking
Absolutely.
The one who was beaten to death.
One that has been reported.
61-year-old
man? At
least
one person has been reported to have died since then.
And this is after the National Guard
after
were moved
the
into these
Guard,
prison
yes.
facilities.
Yeah, I wanted to bring in Orisanmi Burton, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at American University, author of The Tip of the Spear, Black Radicalism, Prison Repression, and the Long Attica Revolt. Could you talk somewhat about the role of a correction officers, especially in your book on Attica? You went back in time, of course, the Attica Revolt being one of the biggest in American history and its impact on reforms within the prison system.
Yes, well, the role of the guards is really to enforce domination. And Jose was exactly right in talking about the role of solitary confinement, all of this. Of course, a repeal of the HALT Act is really the primary demand of the guards. And this is a legacy of Attica. So in the wake of the Attica Rebellion, we saw nationally the proliferation of solitary confinement and the extension of the lengths of time to which people were subjected to solitary confinement. And this was really an effort to assert control and domination over the prison population. People might be aware of this popular narrative that solitary confinement is about confining the worst of the worst, but you just heard from Jose the different categories of people that the HALT Act was designed to prevent from being put into solitary confinement. And there's also a pronounced political dimension to the use of solitary confinement. So, for instance, in the 1980s, the warden of the Marion Control Unit, which is a supermax prison in Illinois, said that the purpose of the Marion Solitary Confinement Unit is to control revolutionary attitudes within the prison system and within the society at large. And so part of this is the use of the prison as a form of counter-revolution. And the guards are really in place to enforce that dominance and to ensure that prisons remain quiet. And for the most part, people don't hear about it, but because this video was released, people have no choice but to be faced with the kinds of violence that happen all the time in prisons.
Professor, if you could talk about, and you talk a lot about this in your book, what you think needs to happen now, the whole issue of abolition versus reforms as the legacy of what happened after Attica, and explain what happened then.
Right. So, I mean, the dominant narrative of Attica is that it's a four-day rebellion that unfolded largely within Attica prison and that the demands were primarily oriented towards improving prison conditions. I don't think that that's wrong. I just think that it's incomplete. My book shows that Attica was a protracted struggle that lasted for at least 13 months, that it traversed multiple prisons, and that it was revolutionary and abolitionist in its politics, that it was informed by anti-colonial movements unfolding throughout the world, and that it had material links to those movements. Part of the response to Attica was massive repression and violence, as many of your viewers will know. But the focus on the intense violence waged by the state often obscures the extent to which reforms were used as a counterinsurgency method designed to suppress political consciousness and suppress activism. And so one of those reforms was the proliferation of solitary confinement, as I just mentioned. Other reforms were just the proliferation of prisons in general, which were used as a method to separate out more prisoners so that they couldn't organize. But importantly, the proliferation of prisons was also used as a way to market prison growth and development to white rural populations whose economies had been ravaged by deindustrialization. So it was a way to sort of shore up support for rural white workers who had very few other employment options, especially in light of the fact that during the repression at Attica, the New York State assault force that went in to suppress the rebellion also killed several of the guards, 10 guards. And so the building of prisons became a marketing tool to try to build support for prison development among rural white populations. And much of this is what we're dealing with now in terms of the some of the demands and conversations around what's happening with the strike have to do with animosity around the recent closure of prisons that has been unfolding in New York over the past decade.
And you mentioned earlier solitary confinement used as a means of political repression of revolutionary movements. Could you talk about what your book found in terms of Attica, specifically the level of political activism that occurred in the prisons? I know when I was in the Young Lords back in the 70s, we actually had members in Attica as part of the Inmates Liberation Front, but the Black Panther Party, the Nation of Islam, many other political groups, Republic of New Africa, had membership and developed membership in Attica and other prisons as well.
Absolutely. And the Inmates Liberation Front is discussed in my book. I mean, part of what I want people to understand is that prisons in the United States are best understood as institutions of low intensity warfare that masquerade as apolitical instruments of crime control. And so part of what we see in the late 1960s is the use of prisons to repress and contain and neutralize political activism on the outside, groups like the Black Panthers and the Young Lords, as you just mentioned. But But in fact, what happens is that this strategy backfires, and prisons, in fact, become schools of revolutionary political education. And these groups, in fact, proliferate in the prisons. And that politicization interacts with the intense repression that these groups were facing, which gives rise to these different forms of rebellion that emerge all throughout the prisons. Attica happened to be one of the most brutal prisons in New York State, and in fact, in the country, where many of the most political and most intellectual, and most charismatic people were transferred and repressed, and it turned into a tinderbox.
Professor Burton, that's where the wildcat prison guard strike is. Jose Saldana, we just have 20 seconds.
They have engaged in illegal activity, and they will continue to escalate that illegality. We are building a movement to dismantle this racial brutality. But in the meantime, we have to get people out of that brutal system. We have legislation, elder parole, fair and timely, second look at. These legislation will help relieve people out of these systems of brutal oppression and unite them back to their families.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Jose Saldana, director of RAP, and Arsanmi Burton, author of Tip of the Spear, Black Radicalism, Prison Repression, and the Long Attica Revolt. He's also a professor of anthropology at American University. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
return to the classics.
WRHU Hempstead, 89.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh. You're listening to the One World Radio Show on the One World Radio Network. I'm your host, Cody Millar, broadcasting from Pittsburgh. Joined with me from New York is Ricky Hubert, and from Cape Town, Lydia Marquana. Joining us today is Demi from Magical Hijinks. Demi, thank you so much for joining us today on the One World Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
How are y'all doing this beautiful morning and afternoon? Beauty of broadcasting in multiple time zones is we got a variety of weathers.
We're all right, Cody. How are you? How is everything? We're just saying we're all in school zone. I'm a student. Cody's a teacher. So everybody's at like a different stage of the game in terms of the school year.
It's going all right, although it's a little cold at 13 degrees Fahrenheit right now, although it feels more like it's zero.
On my side, it is a super hot, like very, very hot. I couldn't even go outside the way it is so hot. We are on 30 degrees today. So yeah, it's blazing hot.
Well, I'm annoyed with the